This is Radio EcoShock.
What is the role played by the British Columbia government in the ugly tar sands development in Alberta? And how will BC itself suffer if the extra tankers for all these new pipelines are brought along our very beautiful coastlines? This is the executive director of the Dogwood Initiative, Will Horder, speaking on November 25th at 2008 at the Heritage Hall, Vancouver. The event was titled The Tar Sands, The Dark Side of the Boom. It's part of a speaking tour through Alberta and British Columbia.
Before I get into the ins and outs of the tar sands related pipelines and tankers that threaten British Columbia, I want to talk to you a little bit about hope. Hope for the beautiful places and wildlife that you'll see in the pictures that we're showing here. Hope for the animals and the critters that live along BC's magnificent coast. And hope has become a very important thing to me lately. 1 year ago, just a little bit more than a year ago, my wife and I became parents for the first time. We know our daughter is a burgeoning activist because she took control of the agenda and decided to thrust herself into the world 15 weeks prematurely. She weighed a little bit more than a pound. And my life changed in an instant. As a new father, I was humbled by my daughter's efforts first to breathe, then to keep her heart beating, and then to eat, and then to grow. But the moment that she was born, I realized that my role both as a parent and an activist had merged. That successful parenting and activism is about controlling one's own personal fears, stepping into the unknown, and helping people bring forward the best about themselves. Experiencing our daughter's life and death struggle over the past year has reinforced for me the power of hope. Hope has become so important to me and my wife that we named our daughter Asha Hope. Asha means hope in Hindi and life in Swahili. So we thought that both Asha Hope, Hope, and the world needed a double dose of hope and a little bit of life thrown in. So participating in Asha's trial of life has made me think about how you choose life when confronting massive change. And I want to share some of those thoughts with you tonight. Asha's generation was born at a historic time, as we all know if you read the papers. We're at a tipping point where civilization as we know it is beginning to go through tectonic shifts. The consumer-driven growth economy is collapsing every day. The scientists are saying that our addiction to fossil fuels threatens not only our future, but the future of the bears and the salmon and the orcas. The forces allied for business as usual are strong. And like the mythical David, we have to become formidable to slay the Goliath. And that scene can seem to many of us, and it does to me occasionally, very scary and overwhelming. But I believe that there is a path forward, and I think that path can be found in the ideas of hope and resilience. As a parent, I have hope that my daughter can grow up in a world that uses global warming to transition itself to a truly just, equitable, and sustainable world. With some hard work and some good choices, I believe that we can make this happen. Now, we ended on a picture here, after you see that, of a picture of the Great Bear Rainforest. How many of you have heard about that? How many have heard of the Great Bear Rainforest? Well, a lot of people have been investing a lot of hope over a lot of years to create the protected areas and the management regime that's supposed to apply in the Great Bear Rainforest. Unfortunately, these areas in the north are where the pipelines from Alberta end and the tankers will go into. So it's the waters and the shores and the coastlines of the Great Bear Rainforest where the oil tankers are going to transit. And they're under threat. The tar sands are putting this magnificent, globally significant ecosystem at risk. This is where 25% of the world's remaining coastal temperate rainforest exists. The first project, before we start looking at the infrastructure projects that are proposed to support the tar sands in BC, the first one I'd like to mention is Enbridge's Gateway Project. My laser is somewhere here. And you'll see this line right here. It comes from Edmonton out to Kitimat on the coast. It involves two twin a twin pipeline of approximately 1,200 kilometers long. It will go from Edmonton to Kitimat. The pipeline will cross thousands and thousands of streams, many of them salmon-bearing. One of the pipes will be exporting somewhere between 525,000 and a million barrels of oil a day to China or India. The second pipeline will be used to import a toxic mix of petrochemicals that's called condensate, which is used to dilute tar-like bitumen so that you can pump it through pipes and so you can refine it more easily. Bitumen is like tar, and so it doesn't move through pipelines very easily. This project by itself would bring potentially 150 oil tankers a year into the Great Bear Rainforest. The second project is Kinder Morgan's project, and that's actually an expansion of what they call their Trans Mountain Pipeline. And that, you'll see, is this piece right here that comes down into Vancouver. This is an existing pipeline that the company's proposing to expand in four phases. The pipeline, this is the pipeline some of you, well, most of you living in Vancouver, will be very familiar with, especially the folks from Burnaby, because this is the one that burst and spilled about 2,000 barrels of oil in about 25 minutes. The existing pipeline has about 30 tankers a year that service it that come into the area, Briard Inlet. And if this goes forward to all stages, they'll basically double the number of tankers. The next project is Kinder Morgan's as well, and it's the fourth stage of this expansion of the Trans Mountain, and it would actually connect from the existing pipeline here to Kitimat, and it would follow a very similar route to the Enbridge project that I just showed you. This will also export oil to China and India. The last two projects that are important to know about are one is a proposed Pembina pipeline. You can see it right here. It's this little thing here. It's a new pipeline that would go from Kitimat and it would connect to an existing pipeline just north of Prince George where they would reverse and they would basically ship condensate back to Alberta. The second project isn't on here on the map because it's already actually active and tankers are using this right now. It is a project by Methanex and Encana, which is importing condensate into Kitimat. And then they're loading it onto railroad cars that go right along the Skeena River all the way to Alberta. And the Skeena River, for those of you who know, is one of, if not BC's most important salmon river, either after the Fraser or in front of the Fraser, depending on where you live and what the statistics say for the course of the year. So when you're talking about these various pipelines, you need to understand that they basically have impacts, two different kinds of impacts. One will be from the pipeline itself, or all these proposed pipelines themselves, and the other one is from the tankers and the impacts of the tankers. So we're going to go through these. I'm not going to talk a lot about the pipeline impacts, but obviously when you cut a big whack 1,200 kilometers along over mountains, through dales, through streams, etc., you create a lot of damage. They're actually now talking about burying the pipeline, so there's some pictures later on of what that looks like, but it actually causes significant impact about itself. They need roads that go along this pipeline all the entire route because they have to maintain it. And then, of course, there's the risks of spills and ruptures. The second kind of impacts is from the tankers themselves, and I'm going to spend a fair bit of time talking about this. And it's both from just the increased amount of traffic, but also from the various different kinds of spills that occur. What should be aware is every time a tanker connects up to actually load or unload, there is a spill. It's just a question. They don't call it a spill because it's just, you know, a certain number of volumes go into the water at that point. But every time they connect, and it would be two or three times a week for most of these projects, there's a small spill. So here's the route of the proposed routes of the tankers that would go to Kitimat. There's the northern route and the southern route. The northern route would bring tankers through Heckett Strait, here, Dixon Entrance, Heckett Strait here, and then it would go up through Douglas Channel. The southern route down here would come in through Queen Charlotte Sound, over the top of Vancouver Island, Queen Charlotte Sound, Heckett Strait, and then connect into Douglas Channel as well. In doing this, they would basically pass, along the tankers would pass 650 salmon spawning streams, the feeding grounds of the gray and the humpback whales, the migratory route of gray whales, and in this area, this whole area in here, there's 20 federally listed at-risk species that would potentially be impacted. So tankers out of Kitimat, well, what's that look like? Well, the air, these waters are treacherous. A lot of the pictures you'll see, it's when they're calm because it's when you can get in there. This is the fourth most hazardous sea area in the world, according to the West Coast Marine Weather Hazard Manual of Environment Canada. And it's that way, it's so dangerous because it has very short, steep waves that develop quickly over its very shallow waters. It's a combination of deep and shallow waters. So in the winter, sometimes the seas are 8 to 10 meters high. That's common. There's gale force winds that come out of these incised fjords and channels through Kitimat, causing significant rough water and freezing spray. And in the summer, northwesterly winds can routinely travel up to 35 knots. Most of the area, and if you've ever tried to fly into the area, it's poor visibility because of rain, fog, and snow, routinely throughout the year. And we found in a book that said, that was published in the mid-90s, that said the second highest wave ever recorded was in Heckett Strait on a former oil drilling testing facility that they put in place in the 70s. It was over 90 feet high. So given this weather and given the kinds of ships, you're talking about very large crude carriers, VLCCs, which are Exxon Valdez-like carriers. The question of oil spills, it's not a question of when. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when. If the Gateway project went forward, there's an SFU study that said, based on industrial averages, a moderate spill of 1,000 barrels would occur one to every 3 years, and a major spill of over 10,000 barrels would occur every 6 to 7 years. And that's just if the Enbridge project went through at its higher volumes. But despite all precautions, and the reason we say it's when, not if, is because despite all precautions, accidents happen. This here picture is of a barge that overturned in Robson Bight. Have you been following that in the news over the last year or so? Any of you? Raise your hand if you've heard about this. Yeah, it was a barge carrying some diesel oil. It overturned in August of 2007 in the environmentally sensitive area of Robson Bight, which is an ecological reserve, and there's big questions about why the barge was in there in the first place. And that's on the northeast coast of Vancouver Island. It spilled about 85 barrels of diesel oil. 85 barrels. So remember those statistics before that I said? 1,000 barrels every 3 years, 10,000 barrels every 6 to 7 years. This spill was 85 barrels. It took them forever to clean up, and it's still not clean up. It spilled into important orca habitat, and orcas have been exposed to this diesel for long periods of time, and it's going to be interesting to see what kind of health effects that will have. There's currently a dispute going on that's been going on since the spill. Who's jurisdiction this was and who's responsible for cleaning it up between the provincial government and various different branches of the federal government. So this still has not been resolved. Now, the second example that I'm going to show you here is one you may be familiar with. Where do you think this is? Burnaby. Yep, that's right. So this is the Burnaby spill. It was on the Kinder Morgan pipeline, which I discussed before. It spilled less than 2,000 barrels of oil in 25 minutes. And a lot of it went into Burrard Inlet through the storm drains. Now, what's interesting about this is Burrard Inlet and the lower mainland in these areas, that's where all the cleanup equipment is. There's none up on the north coast. It's all down here. And they still couldn't clean it up, even though it happened almost right next to the cleanup equipment. So that puts it in perspective. The third example is the Queen of the North. Now, the Queen of the North is a ferry that was actually built for the small in size channels in the inside passage, so it's small and maneuverable. It actually sunk right along the tanker route, just adjacent, right around the corner from Hartley Bay and Douglas Channel. It had less than 2,000 barrels of diesel on it, which has been leaching out at various different rates since. Depends on who you listen to, whether you listen to the government or you listen to the local First Nations about whether it's still leaking. They have not cleaned that up yet. There's a dispute about that and some lawsuits. The heroes of Hartley Bay, the First Nations there, are still fighting to clean it up. And when we met with the elders up in that area, we went up and there was a potlatch with some friends of mine went, and when we went up there, we said, well, what can we do to help you? And they say, stop the oil tankers from coming to our waters. The last example is the Exxon Valdez. That's a picture there. And we're still seeing the devastating impacts of this. And I don't know if this is going to work or not, so we'll see. I actually have some a clip of sound here, but it's not working. We had a clip of sound from one of the women who was in charge of the cleanup and was one of the first people on site, and what she felt when she landed there with her hazmat suit, and how she just started bawling because she knew, despite the training and despite having more resources, the best resourced cleanup facilities in the world, there was nothing that they could really do. She says it much more eloquently than I do. But the effects of the Exxon Valdez, as I said, are still being felt. 250,000 birds were estimated to have been killed, along with an estimated 22 killer whales, 2,800 sea otters, 1.9 million salmon, and 12.9 billion herring, which is the basis of that whole ecosystem. Now, some of people think that Exxon Valdez is the worst oil spill in history. Well, in fact, it's not. It's the 35th largest oil spill, and since the Exxon Valdez spilled, there's been many larger than that that have occurred throughout the world. So when people start talking to you about, oh, don't worry, that was the old days, now we have double-hulled tankers, the regulations in Canada do not require double-hulled tankers to flow in Canadian waters until 2020. So don't believe that. So what are the impacts in BC of oil spills potentially? Well, the impacts would be devastating. Don't just read the list for yourself, but basically thousands and thousands and thousands of existing jobs would be put at risk. 16,000 commercial fishing jobs, sports fishing jobs, tourism jobs. There's 500,000 to 800,000 cruise ship passengers go through those waters where the tankers go on an annual basis. All that would be put at risk. Many, many parks, the Great Bear Rainforest, the Gowanus World Heritage Site, basically the coastal icon, the things that define British Columbia would actually be put at risk. So now some of you may be wondering, isn't there an existing moratorium on oil tankers in these waters already? Well, the answer is yes, there is. And the government of Canada imposed a moratorium on oil tankers on the North Coast 35 years ago, in 1972. And the terms of reference, this has been confirmed over the years, and in recent documents, the terms of reference of two federal panels basically explicitly say that there's a moratorium banning oil tankers in Hecate Strait, Dixon Entrance, Queen Charlotte Sound, and Douglas Channel. However, and Trudeau imposed that in 1972, and eight prime ministers basically have stood behind that moratorium. That is to say, until Stephen Harper became prime minister. Because of some strange mistake that was made in terms of documenting that existing moratorium, although there's many documents that refer to it since, the original documentation cannot be found. So the Canadian government's position now, quietly, they haven't put out an advertisement of this, but basically is that the moratorium doesn't exist. And there's been a fair bit of confusion this last federal election in certain ridings where we raised this issue about what the actual law requires. And their position is, they talk about a ban on tankers, but what they're referring to is what's called the voluntary tanker exclusion zone. So the moratorium was put in place in 1972, and all the documents that refer to the area up until the switch in government document and refer to that moratorium. Now the new government's position is that this voluntary exclusion zone that was brought into place in 1988 that only applies to tankers that go from Alaska to the United States and bans them from the inside passage, that's the only thing that exists. Nothing else exists. Therefore, and why is that important? Because it means that all of these tar sands-related projects can go forward. So that's the bad news. The good news is that before the last federal election, every party, Dogwood Initiative and some other groups, were able to get every party except for the Conservatives to commit to a ban on oil tanker traffic through BC's North Coast, to commit to a legislated ban, whether they're in government or whether they're in opposition. And even the Conservatives, because of the high-profile nature of this issue in certain areas where the Conservatives were vulnerable, the Conservatives actually made some commitments. So I'm going to read you what was in this very bizarre statement that was in their platform. It's called Prohibiting the Export of Raw Bitumen to Higher Polluting Jurisdictions. And they said, a re-elected Conservative government led by Stephen Harper will prevent any company from exporting raw bitumen, unprocessed oil from the tar sands, outside of Canada for upgrading in order to take advantage of lower pollution or greenhouse gas emission standards elsewhere. Now, what's interesting about that is the only thing it applies to is basically West Coast pipelines exporting to China, which means the Gateway Enbridge project and the other ones I listed. So this is an interesting change, and we're not certain actually what kind of impact it will have. A little bit more bad news before I get to the last part of the good news is that despite some good initiatives here in BC by the government around climate change, The Liberal government of BC has proposed an energy corridor, they announced it in the last throne speech, that would include the area for the Enbridge pipeline. They're proposing this to get around the First Nations objections and First Nations opposition. This is a major contradiction with their climate change aspirations, because the increased emissions that would be facilitated by this from the tar sands would basically wipe out all of the emission gains from all the other initiatives that we're trying to implement in British Columbia. So they've made commitments about reducing greenhouse gases by 33% in British Columbia. Well, if they allow the tar sands pipelines, the increase of emissions out of the Alberta would actually balance that out, and we'd be net zero for all the hard work we do in British Columbia. So the tar sands aren't just an Alberta problem or a national Canadian problem. They're a global problem with a local face. And if Canada wants to do its part to address global warming, the Alberta tar sands simply can't be allowed to grow by the 400 or 500% that Mr. Bush and Mr. Harper are pushing for. And the tar sands pipeline tanker projects cannot be built. And it just can't be allowed to occur. So global warming will lead to inconceivable changes in our lifetime. And the folks up in Fort Chipewyan are already seeing some of those kinds of impacts. But here locally, it's going to mean warmer local waters. And with warmer local waters, it means that the salmon are going to die. And with the salmon go the wolves, and with the wolves go the bears, and the rainforest goes, and the First Nations people along the coast, and many of us. And I simply don't want my daughter to grow up in that world. I can't even imagine what that world looks like. And I'm going to work my tail off to make sure that it doesn't happen, but I'm going to need your help. We, the people of BC, have a very special role to play in this. We can do something to stop these five tanker pipeline projects and rein in the tar sands. The leaders of our respective governments, the cabinet ministers that come throughout BC, both in the federal and provincial government, they have the power to stop these projects. But so far, they've been cheerleaders or silent supporters. That's why we need to get a legislative tanker ban. Knowing our government's addiction to fossil fuels, we know it's going to be hard. But as I've learned over this last year being a new parent, things can change very, very quickly. I have hope. I know we can make this happen. And the good news is it is actually happening right now. Some of you have signed the petition in the back. You've joined 28,000 other British Columbians who've signed that petition, mostly in the key cabinet ministers' ridings across BC. Dogwood Initiative has also been very successful over the last year or so, or the last few years, in delaying most of those projects that you've seen by monkey wrenching their finances. We've been playing in the financial markets to try to scare the money away from them, and we're going to continue to do that. And this pressure that we're bringing to bear is working so far. All of the projects on the coast have not moved forward at their timelines, and none of them's a done deal yet. But to get a legislated ban on tankers, we're going to need to put a knockout punch in place. And that's the legislative tanker ban. We may be able to slay Goliath. He may have been able to do it by himself, but we're going to need a heck of a lot of help. So as we move forward, here's what we can do. Sign the petition. We need somebody who owns $2,000 worth of Enbridge shares to donate them to us or to work with us so that we can put a shareholders resolution forward. We're already working with some of the SRI funds, but there's lots of people who own Enbridge shares across the country. It's been considered a safe investment. So if you know anybody, have them get in touch with us. You can continue to own them. We can just act as your agent. You can volunteer with Kelsey at the back table. Well, we have some pretty exciting things that we're going to do coming in the new year. So stopping the tar sands pipeline, we know, is not going to be easy. The pro-fossil fuel forces in BC and across Canada are strong, but over 80% of British Columbians are opposed to tankers, including that cuts across all political parties. They think it's crazy to put BC's coast at risk so that China and India and the U.S. can continue their addiction to oil. By working together, we can end this insanity. Here's what we're going to do in January. We have a Tankers Are Loony campaign. We have these stickers, which you'll see, that go on loonies, and we're going to try to get 1 million of those suckers in circulation around British Columbia and around the world. We're targeting all the cabinet ministers' ridings all the way across the country. We're looking for businesses. We're already in negotiations with a number of businesses. This is phase one. Phase two is a tar sand sticker, the same thing. The black on there signifies an oil spill. We already have a lot of people interested in this, so sign up if you want to do this. We'll send you these things. We want you to empty out your cash, your piggy banks, whatever you have loonies. We want you to stick them on there and get them in circulation to tell this government that you're not going to stand for this. So in closing, I started with thoughts of hope, and I want to end with thoughts of hope. I want to tell you a small, very quick story about a fellow by the name of Nahshon. How many of you have heard of him? People who are study the Bible or the Old Hebrew Bible? Nobody? Okay. Well, I heard this story recently, and I thought it was pretty interesting. Some of the commentaries of the Old Hebrew Bible relate this story, and I think it has a lot that we can learn from it. Nahshon was a man who was a noble person, and he was around 20 when he was with Moses, when Moses was on his exodus with the Israelites to flee the Egyptians. And after a long journey, they came to the Red Sea, and they couldn't go any further. And they were stuck there. What do we do? Big sea, can't cross it. They were stuck, and they were despairing, and they were fearing for their lives, frankly. And Moses got up and made a bunch of proclamations, but nothing happened. The night came, and the Israelites stood on the banks of the Red Sea, and they wailed in despair. And that continued until the next morning. The Red Sea was there, and they didn't know how they were going to get away. When quietly, this fellow by the name of Nahshon entered the waters. He walked out into the Red Sea, and everybody thought he was nuts. They thought he was crazy. He walked in up to his thighs initially, and everybody's watching him. Then he got up to his waist, and then he got up to his shoulders, and people thought he was actually trying to commit suicide. But once he was up to his nose, magically the waters of the Red Sea parted, and they were able to escape. Now, the reason I tell you this story is because sometimes when you venture out to do something, it doesn't seem like it's going to actually have any impact. The first time we gave a Tar Sands presentation like this, my organization, there was 4 people in the audience. We've subsequently filled rooms with 800 people talking about this in various locations up and down the British Sea Coast. And what Nahshon and I think my experience as a father can teach us is that a group of committed, resilient people who have hope can perform miracles. In the final analysis, it's up to us. The actions that each of you take, as Mike said, is going to determine our fate and the fate of the BC Coast. And we need your help. We need you to help us, and we need to help each other. Because the children like Ashahope and your children and your grandchildren need us to become formidable. Not tomorrow, today. And I know from personal experience that if you take a little bit of hope, add a little bit of life, mix in some hard work, miracles can happen. So our time is now. Let's get to it. Thank you very much.
I'm Alex Smith, and you've just been listening to Will Horter, the Executive Director of Dogwood Initiative, speaking about the little-known support that the infrastructure-based and proposed pipelines in BC provide to the current and future tar sands development. It was on November 25, 2008, at Heritage Hall, Vancouver. The event was titled The Tar Sands, The Dark Side of the Boom. It was part of a speaking tour going through Alberta and British Columbia. The sponsors included the Council of Canadians, the Vancouver Burnaby Chapter, QPBC, Greenpeace, Tar Sands Free BC, the Sierra Club, the Dogwood Initiative, the Institute for Citizen Journalism, Check Your Head, North Coast EnviroWatch, Western Wilderness Committee, and the Polaris Institute. You can get the rest of the evening as recorded by Radio EcoShock at our website at ecoshock.org. Just look for our audio on demand menu and then choose Alternative Energy. You'll see a whole bunch of files on the tar sands there, including the rest of the speakers. One of them was Mike Mercurdy, a member of the Athabasca Chip First Nation, and also Jesse Kalman, the tar sands campaigner with the Polaris Institute, speaking on the social and environmental impacts of the tar sands. To stop the future destruction of the BC coast by tankers, which should never be there in the first place, be sure to check with notankers.ca. You can sign a petition and you can get active at notankers.ca. That's it for Radio EcoShock this week, and thank you so much for listening.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.